and welcome to another episode of Consumer, the European podcast of the Consumer Choice Center. As always, I'm your host, Bill Wirtz, with Billy Joel's Pressure fading out in the background. This is the episode of October 21st, 2021, and happy all-time high day to all of you crypto investors, especially those who hold Bitcoin. Bitcoin reaching the sky, deservedly so, I would say, because traditional currencies are not as trustable, and we see that on the crypto markets. My guest this week is Franz Schellhorn. He's the head of Agenda Austria, a think tank in Austria, and we'll be talking about Austrian politics, the recent political crisis, and what he thinks are the biggest challenges facing Austria in the future. Also in this episode, Latvia is going into a new full lockdown. I'm chatting to my colleague Luca Bertoletti about Alitalia and its transformation to ITER. And we're talking, of course, energy prices. Energy prices is the big topic of the month, rising prices in natural gas. So that'll also be in this episode. So let's get started. Just a very short news here that I wanted to get into first. Latvia announced a COVID-19 lockdown from October 21st. So that's actually today. Until November 15th. Our health system is in danger. The only way to get out of this crisis is to get vaccinated, Prime Minister Kristianis Kariņš said after an emergency government meeting. So in Latvia, 54% of adults are fully vaccinated. The EU average is 74%. And this full lockdown means that restaurants, shops, schools, entertainment will be closed. And also there will be a curfew between 8 p.m. and 5 a.m. For those residents in Latvia. However, international travel will not be affected. That seems to mean that you can still freely travel to Latvia and also leave the country. Of course, an option not available to a lot of those people in Latvia who are on lower incomes. Unfortunately, there being more of those than in the rest of the European Union. I think this is unfortunate news. Ultimately, the people who have the option to be vaccinated already have had that option for quite a few months now. And the rest of the people have clearly indicated that they do not want any protection. So that should be up to them. I think for Latvia, this means terrible news for the economy. And ultimately, it won't really help curb this pandemic. I know that Latvia has already requested help from the European Union to this regard. But it's also had protests within the country against those measures. We'll see how this goes, especially to see how it will affect the other Baltic nations in the region. Also, we see that in the UK, increasingly doctors are demanding a return to full lockdowns because of new mutations. This is mutations outside of the existing Delta variant. So we'll see. We'll see how we'll end up and how exactly the winter will play out. But now let's talk to my colleague, Luca Bertoletti, about Alitalia. For those of you who don't know, Alitalia is an airline, the national airline of Italy, which has been bankrupted quite a few times already. There have been bailouts by the Italian state, and now it's really the end of Alitalia. It's moved to ITER Airways. And so I was talking to Luca about this topic. We've talked about this before. And take it away. It's not the first time we talk about Alitalia. You've been on the show before to talk about this issue. Alitalia is gone. There's a new airline, technically, but how much does it actually change? That's what we're trying to find out. So, Luca, what exactly has changed now that Alitalia does not exist anymore?
Everything and nothing. Well, first, thank you, Bill, for having me here to talk about Alitalia. What changed is, the European Commission agreed on this bailout for Alitalia, but probably, I think I'm 30 and I pay one every 5 years, so you can do the maths. But I'm 31, by the way. But to make an idea, if Alitalia was actually changing completely, so the government decided to change it, the people were actually piloting and serving on the plane and also handling on the ground are very different from the previous one. There was a real recruiting done by an external agency. The plane is totally different than previously. The management is incredible. Personally, I could say a good management. One of the C-level is actually Altavilla, Mr. Altavilla, who is previous Fiat FCR Kreisler was the guy that with Marchionne actually made it possible that Fiat was going to buy Chrysler. So let's say that on the papers, it looks totally a different company. New people, new management, a new plane, and we're going to go all Airbus scrapping the old one. But there is something that will never change, and is the fact that Alitalia has a real big problem in Italy, which is the Italian market. So as a company which starts from scratch, and they start in the middle of a pandemic, this new company is called ITA Airways. It's not called anymore Alitalia. So they even changed the the brand and almost also the logo. Like the A is missing one line, because now it has the Italian flag. It's green, red, and white. So it's missing one line, while before it was just red and green. So it's actually totally different from the papers. But as I said, the Italian market, because of the past choice of Alitalia, is full congestionated by locals. Roma airport, because of the crisis that Rome city is having right now, is not able to explode as they should. It cannot be the big hub that we want to be. So, and ITA Airways, in the agreement with the European Commission, decided that they are not going to be in the north. So their main hub will be just Rome, not anymore Milan Malpensa.
So if I understand this correctly, the problem of this airline is that domestically people can connect on low-cost airlines and even like fast trains between the cities. So that's one problem. And internationally, intercontinentally, there's already a lot of competition and offers. So what can the airline technically do?
The problem is even downer. So Alitalia in 2001 decided to go one hub in Rome and leave completely Milano Malpensa. Milano Malpensa got in a huge crisis for many years, but now Milano Malpensa, which is the second biggest airport in Italy after Rome, besides the pandemic, is actually going very well. So it has a lot of point-to-point flights, so which are not technically connecting flights, because you arrive to Milan, you fly to New York, you fly to Miami, you fly to Singapore, etc., Dubai, etc. And there is Milano Linate. So now the problem of ITA Airways that is facing is that if I'm in Venice, for me it's faster and cheaper to take an Italo train or Trenitalia, which is a state-owned company for Ciarossa, arrive to Malpensa directly, basically doing one change in Milano Centrale, the main train station. And in 3 hours, I'm in Malpensa. I don't have to do anything. I can check in on my flight to Dubai and go to Dubai. If I have to fly, I need to fly to Rome, which is already 2 hours from Venice. And I'm making an example of Venice, but any other city, basically, because Rome is quite far from the north. So it's more convenient if I want to fly, if I fly to Vienna or if I fly to Munich. So they actually have this very big problem of not being able to present a real business plan, which say, okay, we are going to focus on just intercontinental flights. The idea of ITA Airways that we mentioned in the press conference, etc., is to present just compete on the local market with low cost, which is very difficult for an airline who wants also to compete on the intercontinental market. I think before the pandemic, it was quite clear that Norwegian, EasyJet, and any other Ryanair, any other company that tried to do intercontinental flights failed. And any big company that tried to do local flight and compete on low cost failed. So there is this, the market is quite, I would say, polarized between where we can compete and where we cannot. And Alitalia has this crisis that we don't want to become a small company. And that's what they want to be, the grandeur of Alitalia of the 70s, 80s, beginning of the 90s, when you were flying Alitalia because it was one of the best company in Italy. Actually, it was the best company in Italy. And on the other side, you have don't want to go just on the international market because you actually cannot, you don't want to lose that, and you don't want to go against the locals because you cannot compete. I mean, you don't have the capacity of Ryanair, you don't have the capacity of even of smaller part like Vueling or Air Nostrum from Iberia, IAJ group. So that will be problem for Italia.
In Luxembourg, we have this saying, having eyes that are bigger than your stomach. So just trying to take on too many challenges at the same time. We are out of time already, Luca, but I wanted to just end with this. You seem to suggest that this is going to stay a problem for in the future. So next time around, when ITA Airways is struggling, do you say, okay, now it's time to say, just let it die?
Well, the funny thing is that we are already talking with Lufthansa, so that Lufthansa, if European Commission agrees, which I don't think it will, but that's another story, another podcast, to buy some share. So they already know that we are in trouble. So yeah, let it die. Give it to the German taxpayers. The Italian taxpayers already paid enough.
But now let's talk about energy prices. Energy prices really are the talk of the month. All around Europe, increased prices for natural gas, and there's a lot of different reasons for that. The news definitely already has reached across the pond.
Let's cover energy prices right now as well, because that's been a huge part of the story. Brian Sullivan's here, and he's been tracking this really closely. He's got a great look for us right now at a lot of the catalysts for why this is happening. Hey, Brian.
Yeah, Becky, good morning. How much time do you have? I mean, what's not the catalyst? I mean, in the United States, obviously, we've got boosting demand. We've got reduced supply in some cases. Oil production has not gone up the level that demand has gone up. I mean, if you look at traffic statistics in many cities, we are seeing traffic now above even pre-pandemic levels. Nobody's taking mass transit. Everybody's driving. And so we are seeing gasoline demand on the rise. Well, not credit records, but still up. But a bigger story around the world. And I think that, again, and we're not, you know, sort of harping on this too much because you can't harp on it too much. Let's talk about Europe. In Europe, they are seeing natural gas prices, in some cases, 25 or 30 US dollars equivalent. Our natural gas prices, you could see there, we're down a little bit right now. We're at $5.50. So why are we at $5.50 and Europe at 25 or 30, with China, by the way, paying over 30 for liquefied natural gas? Well, it's a result of a couple of things. Number one, they didn't buy a lot of storage during the pandemic. Maybe it's because they underestimated the boom in demand coming out of the pandemic. Maybe they thought the pandemic might go on and lockdowns would go on longer. So they were short on storage already, guys. Now, all of a sudden, you're also seeing a shortage of some of the renewables, the wind power in Italy and in the North Sea, just not producing as much. You had a shortage level because they screwed up and didn't buy enough natural gas. Then you don't have enough power coming in. And all of a sudden you realize, oh my gosh, are we going to have enough raw materials to power the power plants? We need to start buying.
Now, as for the reasons who's fueling this increase, there's different different viewpoints on this. I know that Deutsche Welle, they had an expert on gas imports and exports, and he had this to say.
Energy consultant Andreas Löschel is concerned about the rise in gas prices demanded by Russia, Germany's largest gas supplier. Russia is a very strategic player in the gas market, which means that economic interests are in the foreground. Shortages naturally drive prices up and are very profitable to Russia. More than half of Germany's natural gas supplies come from Gazprom Germania, a company close to the Kremlin. The company has declined to comment.
But that is not the only view. The view that Russia is influencing and benefiting from this price hike is one of the theories. Not entirely sure how Russia is driving this crisis. There are different viewpoints. I know the Euractiv had this op-ed by Daniela Bokharev. She's an associated researcher at UC Louvain. And she says in her piece, which will also be available in the description of this podcast episode, that the EU gas storage units were fairly depleted. There's different reasons, as was mentioned also by CNBC, the fact that apparently European Union member states were not really thinking that we would get out of the pandemic as quickly, or that demand levels would rise after the pandemic to pre-pandemic and above pre-pandemic levels. So that's one part. She says also in her articles that the EU 27 and UK gas stores were 72% full compared to 94% full at the time at the same time in 2020, 85% full on average over the past 10 years. And then she also says what is interesting, she quotes from Bloomberg, she says that Gazprom has just 2 months to build its depleted inventories and must therefore pump 80% of its daily exports to Western Europe into storage at the time. I think another thing that we've talked about in the past is that Germany, in terms of energy production, had a very difficult year in 2021 with lower wind and solar power production overall. But of course, for heating, that doesn't make a big difference because, of course, Germany's not heating with electric heaters. But a country that is doing that is France, which is less affected. I remember that the 3 years I lived in France, we were using electric heaters and electricity was fairly cheap because of nuclear energy. And as, of course, Germany's phasing out its like a few of its remaining nuclear reactors, I think, in December, and then the last three ones in December 2022, there again, that option goes away completely. And energy independence is an important factor because it's not like we are importing from friendly nations. We simultaneously have a very difficult situation with Russia and a sanctions regime against Russia, rightfully so. But then at the same time, we also need countries like Russia and Kazakhstan and Azerbaijan and so on for our energy needs. And I think that puts us in a very difficult political situation. And this is also, of course, something that Fabio Fernandez and I have discussed in the episode that we co-hosted, which was episode 44, if I'm not mistaken. So you can go back and listen to that as well. I think a lot more will be said about this. This will be an increasing crisis. I know that France is already reducing taxes on energy suppliers in the move to hopefully see prices being reduced. It's going to be a tough winter for a lot of people. Those on higher incomes, less, of course, but those on lower incomes will really, really have a hard time. And of course, we hope for a winter that's not as cold, but ultimately, this is not something we can influence. What we can influence is diversify our energy grid. And I think nuclear power should also be part of this energy mix and an increased part of it. But now let's move to the interview of this week. My guest is Franz Schellhorn. He's the head of Agenda Austria, a think tank in Austria. And we talk about everything related to Austria's recent political scandal, what he thinks can be should be done in Austria in the future in terms of reforms. He talked a lot about pensions, which is a big issue in Austria. So take it away. Franz Schellhorn, he is the head of Agenda Austria. And we had a few questions here, what has been happening in Austria. A lot of the politics seem to be going all around. So Franz is here to help us out. Franz, first of all, thank you for being on the program.
Welcome. Thank you for having me.
So for the audience that has been following different issues and hasn't really been staying on the loop on Austria, just explain briefly for our audience, what exactly happened politically in Austria lately, and where are we now exactly?
Well, since the so-called Ibiza affair came to light, the public prosecutor's office has been investigating members of the federal government in Austria for corruption. In the course of these investigations, prosecutors have seized chats that fuel suspicions that taxpayer money was used to boost the popularity of the Austrian People's Party and especially Sebastian Kurz. He was then chancellor candidate in this time. It was before the elections in 2017. And there are also suspicions that manipulated polls were used in the process. And all of this with, as I mentioned, taxpayer money. And this is the case now.
So it seems that now Mr. Kurz is not entirely gone from politics. He will still stay chairman of the party. Does that mean he does still have a political future? What do you think?
I don't think so. I think this is just a way to say goodbye, a slow way to say goodbye, because I think he's going to be a burden for the party when he has to face court. I think the party will have some issues with that, and I think it's just a question of time that Sebastian Kurz is out of politics at all.
And what do we know about the new chancellor? What are your expectations there? bit of a no-name internationally. Who is he?
Yeah, he's the foreign minister. So I think international governments know him, I suppose. He's a totally different type, a diplomat. And I think he is a solution for the time, but I'm not convinced that he's going to be the leader of the party and to run the next election campaign. I can't imagine that.
How do you think this continuation of political crises influences the political approach that the voters take in Austria? How do you think the priorities will shift? Will people more lean on the questions of transparency in government?
I hope so, but in fact, I think this latest scandal will have a big impact, especially because Sebastian Kurz is no longer chancellor. And this means a lot for other parties, because the likelihood that he's not going to be a top candidate for the People's Party is very high. The proceedings take a long time, which I mentioned that he's going to be a burden for the entire party. And I think he is going to be, or the Austrian People's Party is going to be beatable for other parties, which was not the case before. And from a today's perspective, it's very likely that there will be some new elections in Austria. And after these elections, I'm quite sure that we will see a left of center coalition between the Social Democrats, the Green, and the Neos, which is the Liberal Party in Austria. So there is a big impact, and I think it will change a lot in this country.
Now, this is very interesting. You are a guy, you talk a lot about, you look a lot about the reforms necessary for a country like Austria. But internationally, when we look in Europe, you know, we on this podcast, we talk a lot about, you know, the challenges of the European Union. And when the European Union talks about challenges, we talk about Bulgaria and Romania. And we see Vienna as like one of the top, number one, most livable cities, highest standard of living. There can't be any problems in Austria, can they? Is there anything you see that needs significant reform in Austria? Give us a bit of a rundown on what you think the most important issues are for Austria facing in the future.
Oh, there are a lot. I think the very biggest problem is the lack of pension reform in this country. The state pension system is missing 23 billion euros a year. That's the cost of a pandemic every year. And almost a quarter of the federal budget has to be spent to plug the pension hole. Yet we continue to retire undaunted at the age of 60. At the same time, fewer younger people have to finance the pensions of a growing group of older people. But who will do that in 30 years? And the government is not only failing to address this problem, it is making it worse by raising pensions out of hand. And because pensioners have become the most important group of voters. So that's one of the biggest issues here, also from a perspective of the federal budget. Another major problem is the sharp rise in long-term unemployment in Austria. At the same time, the number of job vacancies has reached a new record. This is where a mismatch occurs. Many employees are looking for jobs that no longer exist, especially in the low skilled sector. And unemployment is high in the east of the country, while further west, there is a desperate search for workforce. And people are not willing to change the place of residence for a job. So there are issues. Austria is still better than some countries to be compared to in Eastern Europe, perhaps, or others as well, but definitely not in the top 10 and far away from the Scandinavian countries, from our perspective.
Now, that is very interesting, the fact that you say that people are not willing to move within the country, but then there's a lot of people from outside the country that are willing to move there. Immigration is a big factor in Austria. When you go to Vienna, you have people from all over Central and Eastern Europe who move in. How does immigration play into? Because I know that the Chancellor Kurz has always also been controversial and flip-flopping and changing positions on the issue of immigration. How does immigration play into the factor of social security systems and unemployment systems in Austria? Does it affect majorly in that area?
Yes, it does. It does affect majorly, especially in the area of Vienna. All refugees trying to get to Vienna, and also a lot of Austrians are moving to Vienna. It's not a problem to move from Vorarlberg to Vienna or from Salzburg to Vienna, but the other way around is the issue, that people move from Vienna to Salzburg. So Vienna is sort of, again, a sort of a melting pot. And there is a lot of migration into the social security system, which is very attractive in Austria. And this is unemployment in Vienna is extremely high, especially low-skilled people with no language skills and some also older people who are not getting into the labor market again. So there is an issue, and it is connected as well to migration. But we would have we would face also big trouble without migration. But migration makes it a bigger problem without any doubt. And Austria has taken a lot of refugees in 2015, around 100,000, which is quite a lot for this country. We have a big community from Afghanistan in Austria. And so there are a lot of challenges that have not been faced so far.
I think this is very interesting. You know, I'm originally from Luxembourg, and we are a very high migration country, and of course, lower language diversity as a result of the migration. And for the social security system, this has paid out quite favorably because we have very high skilled migration.
Yes.
However, our French immigrants are not happy because the labor market internationalizes and is more English speaking, and because the entire globalized finance system is more English speaking. Do you see something similar in Austria, where the connectivity and the language changes, and that German is sort of sidelined in the finance sector, in the insurance sector, that it becomes increasingly important to have internationals coming into the country?
I mean, I think it's the other way around, that a lot of Austrian companies went abroad when 20 years ago to Eastern Europe. So a lot of companies switched to English as a company language. But the issue we face concerning migration is that in Viennese grammar schools, so the public grammar schools, 64% of the children have not German as their first language. So German is not their first language, which doesn't say that they never learn to speak proper German, but it tells you a lot of the work that has to be done in this area, because these children are looking for a job in 10, 15 years. Austria is looking for high-skilled workers in not even in 10 or 15 years, but now already. So this is going to be a decisive question, whether we can finance our standard of living and our welfare system.
So a lot of challenges incoming for Austria domestically. Now, the question of like the political changes that have just happened is also, what is Austria's standing going to be internationally? Austria has been sort of unofficial leader in the V4, working together with the Czech Republic when it's necessary, when it's about immigration reforms in the European Union. Do you see the position, the standing of Austria changing now that the person that we internationally in Europe all knew, Mr. Kurz, is not present anymore? Will that weaken Austria in international diplomacy, do you think?
I think it's a question if it weakens Austria. It depends who is going to be the next strong figure in politics. I'm not sure if this is going to be Mr. Schallenberg, who is going to continue Austria's policies, I think, within the next months. But the question is, who is going to form the next government? Who is going to be chancellor? And I think the likelihood is very high that this is going to be a social democratic party who is going to run the country again. And then a lot of things are going to change, especially the role of Austria as one of the advocates for budgetary discipline. I mean, Austria has talked a lot about saving abroad while not really saving at home. Even though Finance Minister Blümel has at least made an effort to keep his colleagues' spending wishes in check. But in 2019, so just before the corona outbreak, Austria managed to achieve the first surplus in the federal budget since 1954. So that is after 65 years of deficits without interruption. And so if Austria gets a government led by the Social Democrats, its role in Brussels will certainly change. Fun like the Scandinavian Social Democrats, the Austrian ones do not think much of saving, neither in Austria nor at the European level. And I think Austria had a strong voice which was quite often politically motivated by the goals for that Kurz has set. But there was a voice, and I think this is going to be a different voice in the future.
Now, coming to the end of this segment, thank you so much, first of all. But also, the German liberals, which were rather successful in the German election, they had the slogan, "Never has there been more to do." I assume this would probably be something that you would say as well, that there's a lot to do. And a question that I throw to a lot of the guests that I have on the show is, in the next 5 to 10 years, do you see yourself as somebody optimistic that the challenges you've identified will be solved? Or do you think that it'll take probably a bit longer for the country to get on the right track, budgetary, economically, and all the reforms necessary for the country?
If you had asked me that question 4 years ago, I would have said there is a chance that things are going to be changed in Austria. Which was not the case, really, because we didn't see a lot of reforms during the last years, although the government made the impression of being interested in reforms. There was a window of opportunity, as I would say, it was missed. And I think the likelihood of great reforms is not very high during the next 10 years, given the fact that we still have a 0% interest policy, given the fact that other countries are even in a more difficult situation than Austria, given the fact that European Central Bank is going to be in the same position to finance all the debts and the deficits of the countries, and that we are going to have a very difficult coalition formed by three parties, which is very likely. So I think Austria has still one chance to rely on very, successful businesses that are still able to sell their products abroad, because most of the wealth in Austria is created across the country. So this is our big hope, that individuals, that companies are still effective, successful, and finance the whole country.
And that concludes this week's episode of Consumer. Thank you so much for listening. You can follow Franz Schellhorn on Twitter at Franz Schellhorn, and of course follow the Consumer Choice Center as well at Consumer Choice C. As always, I'm your host, Bill Words. See you Thursday.
You have to learn to pace yourself. Pressure. You're just like everybody else. Pressure. You've only